say that I arrived at McGill, I realize, 37 years ago, just after the Osler Lecture had been inaugurated. And since that time, over the intervening 37 years, I have actually sat in the audience for the majority of the Osler Lectures, very comfortably or somewhat comfortably in the seats that you are now all sitting in this evening. Tonight, standing behind the podium is a little different. I'm not so comfortable, and I'm certainly not going to be taking a cat nap tonight, that's for sure. But I do want to say something, that it would be very nice indeed if in coming years, once in a while, McGill, among the McGill eminent faculty, one or more members could follow on and continue this tradition, occasionally delivering the Osler Lecture. Because this is the first time that an insider has been asked to do this. It's a huge honor. I am deeply honored, but I hope it becomes a little bit of a tradition. So, as you know, tonight's talk is about Alzheimer's. It's not going to be a conventional anthropological talk, not much about culture. In fact, I don't mention culture in one way or another at all. I have called this talk the Alzheimer Enigma. I think of Alzheimer's as a phenomenon, and I think in the course of this talk you'll come to understand why. And hopefully you'll come to understand what a massive task there is in front of the scientists, the clinicians, and all the caregivers and people associated with this condition ahead of us. It's one that we have to approach with as much understanding as possible about the reality of the situation with which we're confronted. So, the demographic transformation currently taking place virtually worldwide, the Grey Tsunami, as it's fashionably known, will, it is claimed, be a drain on economies and drive up healthcare expenditures exorbitantly. What is more, this particular tsunami ensures that we must confront a pandemic of Alzheimer's. The latest estimate for demented elderly worldwide is somewhere between 135 and 150 million by 2050. In short, we're in a moral quiet crisis of global proportions created by the very existence of older people, at least half of whom, it is assumed, will become demented. The palpable fear incited by these predictions is exacerbated by the knowledge that despite ever-increasing spending in the order of billions of dollars over the past two decades, no effective treatment has yet been found to halt the neurological changes associated with AD, although certain drugs are effective for months in some individuals. Experts agree that even if efficacious drugs are developed, medicating patients who are already demented can never be more than minimally effective because the neuropathological damage is by then far too great. This menacing situation has stimulated a significant change in approach to confronting AD, one that is beginning to be implemented through across research conglomerates around the world. Consensus papers were penned by international panels of experts and that appeared in medical journals a few years ago, in which guidelines were set out as to how AD prevention is to be achieved, first in research settings and then, if these results are positive, in clinical practice. At the core of these recommendations is a multi-sited research effort designed to assess who among us is at risk for dementia, with a view to interceding with drugs at the so-called prodromal or pre-symptomatic stage of AD. It's argued that this latent form of Alzheimer's can be detected by a biomarker that may become manifest as much as 20 years or more before behavioral changes of dementia become apparent, whether to affected individuals themselves, their families, or to the clinicians when consulted. In order to achieve this goal, a large investment is currently being made to standardize this and other AD biomarkers, and further to clarify what exactly they signify in terms of individual prognoses. I'm assuming this audience is somewhat mixed, so occasionally I'm giving non-medical people a little bit of help here. This new orientation has been pronounced repeatedly as a paradigm shift. However, Thomas Kuhn would without doubt reject this claim. At most, the move to pre-symptomatic prevention can best be described as a shake-up of normal science, as Kuhn would have put it. Largely because the hypothesis that has grounded AD research and drug development for more than two decades continues to hold sway, albeit somewhat battered and bruised, despite repeated failures in mice and men. Arguably, the most influential article to be published in the Alzheimer world appeared in Science in 1992, co-authored by the British neurogeneticist John Hardy and Gerald Higgins, formerly chief of molecular neurobiology at the NIH and currently working in pharmacogenomics. Subtitled The Alzheimer Cascade Hypothesis, this article quickly became the dominant explanatory paradigm for AD causation at the molecular level. The authors generated this hypothesis on the basis of what was at the time newly discovered findings about the genetics of early onset dominantly inherited Alzheimer's, a rare single gene disorder. They also noted that people with Down syndrome, once adult, very often succumb to AD because the region of chromosome 21 involved in Down syndrome contains mutations that trigger forms of early onset AD. The abstract to this article states, Alzheimer's is characterized by various pathological markers in the brain, large numbers of plaques surrounded by neurons containing neurofibrillary tangles, vascular damage from extensive plaque deposition, and neuronal cell loss. Specifically, the claim was made that, or their hypothesis is, that deposition of amyloid beta protein, the main component of the plaques, is the causative agent of Alzheimer's pathology, and that the neurofibrillary tangles, cell loss, vascular damage, and dementia follow as a direct result of this deposition. Since the publication of the amyloid cascade hypothesis, a vast amount of research has been directed towards solving the question of what exactly leads to excess precipitation of insoluble amyloid and or the failure to clear it from the brain. And by far the majority of drugs have been designed to eliminate amyloid deposition. In 2010, two major clinical trials were stopped in the same week, as had been many others before. In one study, patients taking the drug exhibited worse cognitive problems than did the control group on placebo. And at this juncture, John Hardy, who wrote the amyloid cascade hypothesis, began to publicly declare doubts about his hypothesis. The new preventive regime was consolidated in 2011, and the key biomarker being tracked is amyloid beta protein in cerebral spinal fluid and the subsequent buildup of insoluble amyloid plaques in the brain. This is not a paradigm shift. However, it continues to be unclear as to what exactly is the role or roles of amyloid in the brain and what exactly triggers its deposition. Some researchers stress that amyloid is not simply junk and that it has a function in defense of the aging brain. Others highlight how amyloid apparently assists in maintaining homeostasis and or supports the immune system, among yet other functions. It's also significant that amyloid plaques are associated with conditions, a good number of conditions, other than AD. When I bumped into John Hardy, and I'm not making this up, a couple of weeks ago in a Starbucks in London, it's the one he usually goes to, He was emphatic that we don't know what amyloid does, and he again expressed doubts about the cascade hypothesis. However, other eminent researchers stress that amyloid deposition is both necessary and, in some cases, sufficient to cause Alzheimer's disease, although obviously other factors are involved, and hence the hypothesis is indeed sound. Many of you will have noticed recent media reports about human neurons grown in a gel created in a Petri dish that were then genetically induced to exhibit the neuropathology of dominantly inherited early onset Alzheimer's. In contrast to mouse and other models, this culture produced both beta amyloid plaques and tau tangles. It's less costly to make and takes much less time to screen potential drugs than do animal models. This accomplishment is assumed to be a very strong support for the amyloid cascade hypothesis. But as the New York Times noted, a Petri dish is not a brain, and an in vitro model does not replicate in vivo complexity. Even so, Sam Gandy, a neurologist at Mount Sinai in New York, insisted, "This is a real game changer, a paradigm shifter." He added that he's really enthusiastic to take a crack at this in his lab, and further, his explicit assumption is, if drugs are developed using this new technique, then both early and late onset AD patients will benefit. In 1902, Alois Alzheimer, using a newly developed staining technique, made neurofibrillary tangles visible at autopsy for the first time. Another staining technique had earlier rendered amyloid plaque visible. When Alzheimer's original slides, lost and finally recovered, were re-examined in 1998, it was apparent that his neuropathological observations had been accurate by today's standards, and that he had uncovered the rare condition driven by genetics, early onset AD, in which patients exhibit severe dementia, usually in their 40s and early 50s, and die succumbed shortly thereafter. Medical politics on the part of Alzheimer's boss at the time, the eminent psychiatrist Emil Kraepelin, determined that the 8 autopsied cases Alzheimer had gathered together would be designated as a new disease named pre-senile dementia. Historians argue that Kraepelin made this move in part to counter the attention that Sigmund Freud was getting at the time. Kraepelin carved out of the category of pre-senile dementia, from the much larger category known by everyone of the day, including the public, as senile dementia, a state assumed to be an inevitable part of normal aging. But from the outset, Alzheimer himself vacillated about the creation of this new condition, largely because he had autopsied the brains of numerous older people and found plaques and tangles in many at autopsy. It was this common neuropathology that caused Alzheimer and others to have doubts that a new disease had indeed been found. The evidence brought to light by the latest staining technology was irrefutable proof of this. The assumption persists to the present day among many that neuropathology tells the whole story, as is made clear by responses to the Petri dish experiment. The striking difference in age of onset can be safely set to one side, it's assumed, and as also can the totally different contribution made by genetics to early and late onset AD. Autosomal dominant genes are causal of early onset, and numerous susceptibility genes, almost all of low explanatory power, with the notable exception of APOE4, are involved in late onset. Despite its baptism by Kraepelin for approximately 4 decades, from 1920 to 1970, pre-senile dementia was largely forgotten. No doubt its rarity was largely to blame. The historian Jesse Ballinger points out several major changes that commenced in the 1970s, putting what is now known as Alzheimer's disease firmly on the map again. Among these changes was the development of the electron microscope, permitting refinements in neuropathology. Second, Robert Katzman, an influential neurologist of the day, argued that the stigmatizing label of senile dementia should be dropped, and pre-senile and senile dementia should be solidified as one pathological condition called Alzheimer's disease. Further, concerns about an aging population beginning to fill up hospital beds led to the formation of the National Institute on Aging in the US in the 1970s, and similar moves were made at the same time in other countries. At the same time, incipient Alzheimer movements began to take shape in several countries, effectively helping involve families to bring public attention to the condition. Alzheimer's was first described as a ticking time bomb in the 1970s. Even so, despite concerted efforts to raise funding for research, Alzheimer's funding has always lagged far behind as compared to that of cancer and heart disease. As the Canadian neurogeneticist Peter Hislop puts it, Alzheimer's has never been a sexy disease. In part, I believe, because a lingering stigma remains attached to it, whatever we may think, and because most affected people are regarded as old and decrepit, which we all know is not true. On a more positive note, earlier this year, Dr. Howard Cherko, the co-founder and director of the Jewish General Memory Clinic and head of the Aging and Dementia Research Axis at the Lady Davis Institute, was funded by CIHR and other funders to be the scientific director of a consortium of 350 scientists in 20 teams across Canada. The Federal Health Minister, Rona Ambrose, when she came to Montreal to announce Dr. Cherko's award, claimed that we will have a cure for AD by 2025. In doing so, she followed in the footsteps of President Obama and more recently David Cameron in the UK and other representatives of the EU, all of whom will have AD sorted out by 2025. When accepting the award, Dr. Cherko, who I see is in the audience tonight, judiciously countered the hype. "We are in a maze trying to find a way out," he said, "and we're not sure if we're dealing with one disease or many." So, returning to the AD story, in addition to the difference in age of onset between pre-senile and senile dementia, a second anomaly has been evident since Alzheimer's Day. It's been shown repeatedly that the behavioral changes associated with a clinical diagnosis of AD, above all memory loss, do not always correlate neatly at autopsy with the gold standard neuropathological signifiers of AD, neuritic plaques, neurofibrillary tangles, and cell loss. A good proportion of non-demented elderly have brains loaded with junk, as more than one neurologist puts it. And a recent study indicates that among those over 85 who remain in good cognitive health, almost all have plaques, and some even have tangles in their brains. Until recently, these anomalies have routinely been brushed to one side by most researchers on the assumption of a clinical misdiagnosis. But over the past decade, especially since PIB-PET scanning became available from 2004, these anomalies demand attention. One illustrative example of this discrepancy is the widely cited Nunn study. In 1986, 678 Catholic sisters who belonged to an order called the School Sisters of Notre Dame volunteered to be research subjects for a project that continues until the present day. It is Notre Dame, by the way, this is America we're talking about. Autobiographies written in the 1930s and 40s, when these nuns were in their early 20s, were stored and later matched with neuropsychiatric assessments administered regularly from age 75 years on. These two sets of data were subsequently linked to autopsy findings after death. When volunteering for the project, every nun had agreed to donate her brain for autopsy. One nun, formerly a biology teacher and still very articulate at 96, explicitly wanted to contribute to science. Other nuns stated that one has no need of a brain in heaven. In all, 500 brains have been donated thus far. The advantage to researchers of these particular subjects is that the environmental factors are nicely controlled. The nuns have eaten the same diet virtually all their lives, and they have other habits in common too. Among the several significant findings of this study, it was shown that a good proportion of the nuns who coped very ably with the neuropsychological battery of tests proved at autopsy to have extensive signs of plaques and tangles in their brains, confirming the inconclusive observations made repeatedly since Alzheimer's Day. As the involved neuropathologist put it, these brains are diseased, but there is no sign of dementia. The study also showed that a high proportion of nuns who had dementia proved to have neurovascular damage at autopsy. The brain tissue collected as part of the nun study has now been made available for research projects around the world and has therefore entered the arena of big data global science. Another more recent epidemiological study was carried out at Cambridge University in which a carefully delineated sample of 456 individuals were tested regularly while alive for clinical signs of AD. These subjects had all agreed to donate their brains for research after death. This project showed, as expected, that the neuropathological features assumed to be diagnostic of Alzheimer's disease, including plaques, tangles, and cell loss, are more evident in older than in younger subjects. However, although the correlation between clinically diagnosed AD and with postmortem neuropathology was strong in the group aged between 60 and 75, this finding was shown to be less and less strong with increasing age. Among those aged 75 and over, the researchers were surprised to find a remarkable overlap in the neuropathological features found at postmortem, whether or not these individuals had been clinically diagnosed with dementia. The researchers concluded that AD is best thought of as a diffuse clinical syndrome, and that factors other than the simple presence of so-called Alzheimer neuropathology must contribute to the clinical expression of dementia, especially in those over 75 years of age. A leading member of the Cambridge team, the epidemiologist Carol Brain, has been arguing for years that research into dementia should move away from a model that poses as its basic question, has he got it, to one of how much of it has he got and why. A neat correspondence between states of mind and brain does not exist, it seems, an ontological paradox if ever there was one, and the availability of amyloid imaging has brought this to the fore by rendering this anomaly literally visible. Accumulating neuroimaging findings have shown repeatedly that between 20 to 40% of healthy individuals, often as expressed as up to a third of cognitively normal elderly subjects, carry plaque in their brains. It's evident that these findings are partially dependent upon age and genotype, but this doesn't fully account for the findings. The assumption of most involved researchers is that these individuals are on their way to dementia if they don't first die of something else, and that this accounts in full for the anomalous autopsy findings that have plagued the field over the past century. But other researchers argue that such an assumption can never be proven, even if people live to be 130, and we should focus on what it is that accounts for neuroprotection in these unaffected individuals, something that has consistently taken a back seat. Findings by the Chicago-based neurologist David Bennett and colleagues, published in 2013, may become the wedge that forces some dramatic reconceptualization of the Alzheimer phenomenon. In this study, a total of 467 healthy participants were selected from longitudinal cohort studies. These subjects agreed to numerous annual clinical evaluations designed to assess five cognitive domains, and they donated their brains for autopsy at death, which was on average at 85 years. As have so many other studies, it was found that the brains of most individuals contained recognized AD pathology, including plaques and tangles. The researchers concluded that AD pathology and infarctions, i.e. dead tissue, are common in older persons who do not have cognitive impairment, even though a decline in episodic and working memory was demonstrated in many while alive. The researchers concluded that the bulk of variation evident in cognitive decline with aging remains unexplained. However, so-called normal memory loss associated with aging should not be regarded as benign, they insist, but does indeed indicate the beginnings of a pathological process. Nevertheless, they insist that we must shift the focus of attention to neuroprotection in an effort to detect what it is that enables people to stave off dementia prior to death. As Bennett and his colleagues put it, our understanding of the mechanisms that allow some persons to remain dementia-free despite accumulating neuropathology is still in its infancy. Efforts have been made repeatedly to standardize AD clinical diagnoses over the years on the assumption that this will dispose of persistent disconcerting anomalies. The understanding has been that one must strive to detect pure cases of AD for research purposes. But in recent years, this thinking has changed. David Bennett put it this way when talking to me. He said, along with the Alzheimer's pathology comes all kinds of other things. So, for example, infarcts, Lewy bodies, and other things are contributing to whether someone tips over the edge. We've moved beyond AD as a wastebasket category, and we've got an Alzheimer's bucket now, and in that bucket is mostly Alzheimer's, and we're pretty good at that, but all kinds of other crap also tags along. And the difficulty is that even if you can separate these things out, the value of doing this from a research point of view is dubious at best and probably introduces bias. So, you don't want to be studying pure Alzheimer's disease because you're going to find some really weird things. But people still do this. Epidemiological studies increasingly make clear that among individuals over 75 who are diagnosed with AD, by far the majority do not exhibit pure AD, suggesting that caution is needed, especially in setting up drug trials. Furthermore, several papers have been published arguing that it's time to subdivide the AD category, not only in terms of age of onset, but also with respect to neuropathology. A recent study in Brain proposes that patients with vascular risk factors, cardiovascular disease, and cerebrovascular disease should not be excluded from clinical studies investigating AD because these conditions are present in such a large percentage of demented subjects. And mixed dementia is now regarded as the most common form of dementia by virtually all experts. A further difficulty arises because it's clear that epidemiological assessment of AD cases cannot possibly be accurate. It's been estimated that at least 50% of potential cases in the US alone never come to medical attention. When researchers do surveys using randomly selected samples from populations that are monitored over years, as does the Cambridge group, David Bennett's group, and certain researchers in Northern Europe, then the findings are much more reliable. However, for the majority of projects, subjects are usually recruited from memory clinics, introducing considerable bias. If we think globally, the task of projecting numbers of AD cases and hence the size of the pandemic with which we're confronted, is an absurd exercise because the majority of people with dementia never come to medical attention. It could be much higher than the figures that we're given. On the other hand, it could be much lower. In making estimates about AD cases, we're not dealing with hard facts then, but rather with matters of concern, as the French sociologist Bruno Latour would put it. And amyloid is clearly a coyote-like character, a trickster, as Donna Haraway has characterized certain biological phenomena, an entity that refuses to be pinned down. Amyloid is surely involved in some way in most instances of what is diagnosed as AD, and significantly in other conditions too. But just how and what exactly is its contribution has yet to be elucidated. To date, testing of individuals for AD biomarkers takes place in research settings alone. Once tested, individuals who are cognitively normal but biomarker positive for amyloid are classified as asymptomatic at risk for AD. In 2011, researchers who contributed to the new guidelines dutifully put into print just how little is as yet known about AD biomarkers. The difficulty in the field of AD is that we've not yet established a firm link between the appearance of any specific biomarker in asymptomatic individuals and the subsequent emergence of clinical symptomatology. If we can, however, definitively determine the risk of developing AD dementia and the temporal course of clinical progression, we will open a crucial window of opportunity to intervene with disease-modifying therapy. However, although we hypothesize that the current earliest detectable pathological change will be in the form of A-beta accumulation, it's possible that the A-beta accumulation is necessary but not sufficient to produce the clinical manifestations of AD. Sorry. So this paper continues. We acknowledge that the etiology of AD remains uncertain. And it's also noted that many of the studies on which biomarker findings are based are likely to have cohort biases and are probably not representative of the general population. And caution is further noted that because the biomarkers of interest are merely proxies for the disease, they don't fully reflect the processes taking place in the living brain, as is the case for the Petri dish findings. However, in 2013, the Australian Imaging Biomarkers and Lifestyle Study of Aging Project concluded from a study of just 87 individuals diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment who also had positive amyloid on imaging that virtually all of them became clinically demented within 3 years. So since 2011, some progress has indeed been made towards biomarker standardization and predictions, but many publications have also shown inconclusive findings. There is a long way to go. Most important, the cognitive health of the 30% or so of people with amyloid load in their brains remains unaccounted for. As one of the best-known neurologists in the States, somewhat controversial to some of the experts in the room, John Morris, said some years ago, an additional research focus, of course, should determine why many older adults with neuropathologic evidence of AD manage to remain cognitively normal despite numerous AD lesions littering their brains. There's rather a lot of this littering of brains and junk in brains. It's a little worrying somehow for those of us getting a bit older, getting quite older. So what I want to do now is to consider briefly two research trials underway designed to track biomarkers. Individuals recruited for these trials come from families where dominantly inherited Alzheimer's disease is present. That is, they're recruited from the approximately 5% of families distributed worldwide where AD is known to be caused by autosomal dominant genes. The fact that in these families the onset of disease is very early, around age 40 to 50 years of age, and progression to death is rapid, are advantageous characteristics for the purposes of researchers, because trials, of course, can be of shorter duration and hence are cheaper. And one can predict from genetic testing carried out prior to the trial who exactly is going to succumb to AD. These trials are designed primarily to standardize and harmonize biomarker detection, but the hope, of course, is also to find an effective drug. In the first trial, a multi-sited consortium is carrying out cross-sectional longitudinal studies with over 260 people in the US, Great Britain, and Australia, all of whom carry one of the three genetic mutations associated with familial early-onset AD. This study is scheduled to continue until 2016. Preliminary findings from the original study, limited to the US, suggest that in these families, prodromal dementia is detectable up to 20 years before the appearance of clinical symptoms of dementia. And this seems to be a fairly confirmed understanding now. John Morris, who's director of this research group, heads up this consortium. And in a recent paper with his colleague Randall Bateman, they made the following observation. Because the clinical and pathological phenotypes of dominantly inherited Alzheimer's disease appear similar to those for the far more common late-onset sporadic AD, the nature and sequence of brain changes in early-onset AD are also likely relevant for the late-onset AD. Clinical studies in AD caused by gene mutations are likely to pioneer the way to prevention trials for all forms of AD. I'm going to come back to this point later. Quite dramatically, people from families with early onset AD have become who have long felt neglected by researchers have become a precious resource. A second clinical trial is set up in Colombia, where a large group of 25 extended families, originally of Basque origin, about 5,000 in all, live in both urban and rural areas, scattered mostly around the city of Medellin. These families comprise the most concentrated group of biologically close-knit individuals found anywhere, all of whom carry a specific mutation of the gene presenilin-1, one of the genes that causes early-onset AD. Close to one-third of this population, approximately 1,500 people, harbor what is known locally as PISA. Typically, memory loss becomes manifest around 45 years of age, and most affected individuals progress to full-blown AD by their early 50s. Francisco Lopera, a neurologist associated with the university in Medellin, was the first scientist to pay serious attention to this devastating condition. Once he understood that during the course of three generations, half of the children were affected, he realized that he had stumbled across a form of dementia that most surely must be due to a single gene mutation. A decade later, in the 1990s, the gene was isolated, at which time the finding began to attract international attention. Despite the serious risks posed by drug traffickers and FARC rebels who were very active at the time, Dr. Lopera and his colleagues eventually managed to collect DNA samples and assemble a genetic pedigree extending back nearly 300 years to around the time that these families first arrived as part of the ongoing colonization of Colombia by Spaniards and Basques in search of gold. One scientist has described these extended families as a natural laboratory, providing researchers with an enriched sample who have cleaner brains that can give a better picture than do older subjects. Joseph Arboleda, a Harvard-based researcher who works with Dr. Lopera, stated, "The trial puts the amyloid hypothesis to the test. It's possible that drugs will inhibit the brain plaque, and yet the families will get dementia. Such results would prove devastating for current research. However, if in the extended family the onset of Alzheimer's is delayed or stopped, then the researchers will have hit the mother lode, a potential cure for sufferers worldwide. But," he noted, "that remains a big if." Eric Ryman, the Arizona-based Banner Alzheimer Institute senior PI of the Columbia trial, has also been explicit in suggesting that treatments could be generated to protect millions worldwide from common Alzheimer's. In 2001, he said, if there is no effect on the biomarkers after 2 years in the right direction, we will declare futility. If, however, they do budge in the right direction, we'll continue to follow them a little bit longer to see if it slows even subtle memory decline. If it does, I have a feeling that may be enough evidence for regulatory agencies to consider using biomarkers under their accelerated approval mechanism in other AD populations. When I spoke in July 2012 to Pierre Tario, a geriatric neurologist and an associate director of the Banner Institute, he told me that discussions have been taking place since 2006 about whether or not this trial was really feasible. Among the many questions posed, he said, were, how can the trial be carried out in a way that would be respectful and humble? And should the biological materials obtained from these peoples be regarded as, in effect, a sacred resource? An IRB-approved registry was set up in Medellin in 2012, enabling potential participants to make a connection with Dr. Lopera, and signatories were asked to attend seminars where the objectives of the trial were spelt out and what would be required of research subjects. And the process of randomization was also explained to them at length. So many of these trial subjects have at least 10 years of formal education, but others only have 2 or 3 years of schooling. Not everyone proved eager to participate, but the community as a whole accepted the idea as being a good one. These families are practicing Catholics, and young women are raised to believe that they should have children and that this is part of God's will. Given this situation, local priests were involved in discussions from the outset. One requirement is that women should not become pregnant during the trial and should therefore be using contraceptives. The priests proved to be remarkably cooperative and apparently had no difficulty with contraceptive use for this purpose. After months of silence, the Colombian government finally approved the trial in late 2013, and the hope is to produce interim results by 2017. The NIH is providing $16 million, another $15 million comes from private sources, and Genentech, a unit of Roche, is providing the bulk of the money, $65 million. It's of note that pre-trial results from an exploratory cross-sectional sample of the Colombian subjects suggest that early-onset AD changes are not exactly the same as late-onset common AD with respect to the processes of amyloid accumulation and clearance. Moreover, it appears that neurodegeneration may well take place before plaque deposition, challenging the gold standard diagnosis of AD neuropathology. It may be that these trials will indeed make clear that the amyloid cascade hypothesis needs some serious modification. Very recently, people with Down syndrome have been recruited by researchers at the University of California, San Diego, and at UCL London as research subjects for AD drug testing. Similarly to dominantly inherited AD families, these individuals are particularly good subjects from the scientist's point of view. Virtually 100% will get AD. We're told that these people volunteered willingly to be research subjects, and one teenager, when interviewed, said he wanted to help others. The Petri dish success may well speed up the initial steps of drug testing, but this will not obviate that the phased human testing of drugs that must still be carried out. I have no time to go into the ethical aspects of all this. Maybe that will come up in questions. It's conceivably possible that drugs will be developed that are effective for one or more subtype of AD that strikes at younger ages, that is, the purer forms of AD. But when it comes to people 75 and older, those of us who account for by far the majority of cases of AD worldwide, the entanglement of aging and dementia possibly presents an insurmountable challenge. Aging is the leading cause of AD, and we cannot cure aging, despite the claims of some mavericks. Nor, for the foreseeable future, will globally the majority of AD cases ever come to medical attention. Invaluable extensive insights have been made about AD and dementia since Lois Alzheimer's Day. But the puzzles posed by the two anomalies that troubled him remain unsolved. Are early onset and late onset AD in essence the same condition, despite a huge difference in age of onset? I think not, and increasingly many eminent researchers also think this way. And why, so often in older brains, is there a striking lack of correspondence between clinical signs of dementia and supposed neuropathology? These dilemmas of Alzheimer's remain with us. In addition to the search for effective drugs, implementation of a public health approach is, I believe, an urgent matter. Alleviation of poverty, we always have to say this, but it's true, debilitating inequities and access to good nutrition, sanitation, and education have long been recognized as crucial to human health. And we now know that this includes neurohealth throughout the lifespan. Dementia does not suddenly hit in old age, and biomarker detection of those at risk for AD, if proved effective, will be available for only a very small minority of the world's population. For by far the majority, the prevention or postponement of AD will come about by a reduction of toxic environments, junk food consumption, smoking, obesity, and diabetes, all factors that reduce the risk of vascular dementia and hence AD. Increasing isolation and loneliness of the elderly should also be attended to. A recent study highlights DDT exposure and DDT residues in human blood and tissue as significantly associated with risk for AD. Aluminium is once again recognized as a neurotoxin, and industry is implicated in covering up past findings. Research also strongly suggests that exposure to lead in utero is associated with increased amyloid deposition in the aging brain. It's known that the epigenome is particularly susceptible to in utero deregulation and during neonatal development, puberty, and especially in old age. One article concludes that late-onset Alzheimer's may represent merely an extreme form of normal aging. Epigenetic effects can accumulate throughout life, especially from the time point when the epigenetic machinery suffers from old age. And two 2014 studies produced evidence of extensive hypermethylation in areas of the brain associated with AD neuropathology from three independent cohorts. It was also found that these changes begin to show up early, prior to cognitive impairment, but post the beginnings of amyloid deposition. But similar changes have been found as part of, in quotes, normal aging, indicating once again that other unknown factors must somehow be implicated. I want to finish on a more upbeat note. The Cambridge group, led by Carol Brain, recently published findings about two random samples, each of well over 7,000 individuals aged 65 and over in the UK. And her group had samples of well over 7,000 individuals aged 65 and over and in the UK. One sample was tested between 1984 and 1994, and the second sample between 2008 and 2011. The results showed that dementia rates had dropped by about 24% over the intervening years between sampling. A Danish study studied two cohorts. The first was born in 1905 and was assessed at 93 years of age, and the second was born in 1915 and assessed at 95 years of age. It was found that the 1915 cohort scored significantly better than did the 1905 cohort on both cognitive testing and in being able to carry out daily activities independently. Similar findings are emerging from Sweden, Germany, and the US. So here begins another story. one in which the oft-repeated mantra about a pandemic of Alzheimer's rising exponentially year by year may have to be modified, although, of course, there will be regional variation in AD prevalence for sure. Perhaps accounting for neuroprotection and the development of neuronal density will prove to be less elusive than is the odyssey of tracking AD neuropathology, although thus far it's really not looking this way. Meantime, we must live with headlines such as these. Prions are key to preserving long-term memories! But then you read the article and you find that this is only in sea slugs. And prions, as many of you know, have also been implicated in Parkinson's and AD by causing proteins to misfold. So no story is straightforward. The good news is that recent research has found that imbibing chocolate on a regular basis is great for neuroprotection. Okay, so I'll leave you with this quote from René Dubos, and note the date of 1959. And then I want to go on to show you five images, I think it is, of a remarkable artist called William Utamolan. This is the end of the talk. He was diagnosed in England with dementia. He's an American. He was born in Pennsylvania. And he married a British woman and went to live in London and lived most of his adult life in London. He'd always been an artist. And at that time, he was attended by a psychiatrist as well as a neurologist. And the psychiatrist asked him when he was diagnosed early on if he would consider continuing his painting as the disease progressed. And he said he would do this. He would do his best to do this and that probably it would actually be very helpful to him to continue his painting. And this is exactly what he did. This, as you see, is a self-portrait, 1995, painted at the age of 60. And already you get signs of what you don't see in any of his early portraits, this framing around his head. He's beginning to set himself off from other people. And many of his pictures appear this way, with other people in the same room, including his wife, being separate from him. And the only creature that appears with him is the family cat, but often this framing around himself. The next self-portrait with Saw is 1997, at age 62. And the reason, probably, almost certainly, that this Saw is here is that he had agreed to autopsy after death. And it looks as though he was at some level concerned about this. Another self-portrait, 1997, age 62, getting much more distortion in his face. He was always worried about his ears from a child because he happened to have one ear that was a little bit bigger than the other. This had troubled him a little bit all his life, and here it is, really troubling him towards the end of his life. And the self-portrait with easel, but he chose the easel to frame himself this way, painted at age 63, and erased self-portrait, age 64, and the final image, head one, self-portrait, in the year, painted at age 65. A very disturbing picture, obviously, for all of us. So, I'd like to stop there. I have to recognize that I've had help, research funding from these organizations, and I also want to make an additional comment here, which my rather mediocre, well, it's an average kind of PowerPoint that I had prepared, has been transformed by a graduate student in anthropology, Rad Fadak, into the beautiful images that you saw tonight. So, thank you very much.
Thank you. My name is Professor Andrea Tone from the Social Studies of Medicine Department, and I am pleased to report that Dr. Locke has very graciously agreed to answer a few questions, just a few. You'll see that what we have in the central corridor are stationary microphones, and to ensure that everyone in the room can hear the question asked, including the two of us up here, we'd ask that those posing questions please move toward the mic. And the added advantage is that your question will be preserved for posterity.
Do you think we can have the spotlights off now? Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Considering all the attention that is presently being paid about budgets and the question of money, how do you think that will affect the research matter on Alzheimer's?
Well, I think that there has been a bit of a shift lately. Obviously, cancer, heart disease, and so on will continue to get massive amounts of money. But there has been a big waking up among governments in most parts of the world with respect to Alzheimer's as being an important condition. And one reason that bothers governments enormously is the kind of numbers that are projected from the Alzheimer's Society's projections of how many of us will be demented in the not-too-distant future. This is scary, and the idea is that we, those of us who are of my age group and a bit younger, are liable to bankrupt healthcare systems. So there is an exerted effort now to put money into this, and Dr. Choco's grant is an example of the Canadian government rather belatedly waking up.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Hello, thank you for your talk. In a strange case of serendipity, I recently was speaking with my girlfriend who's in cognitive science about the question of aluminum, which you mentioned briefly. Apparently, her professor had said that the issue was that someone was using aluminum in their solution when they were doing the neuropathology, and that's where the whole scare came from. But I'm very interested in the idea that someone was covering something up. Could you present some evidence or proof or just talk about that a bit? It sounds interesting, and I'd like to hear more.
I'm afraid I don't have the details with me. So, if you'd like to talk to me afterwards, I can make sure you get something on that. I haven't been to the primary sources, but through secondary sources, I noticed in several places that it's now back on the list of toxins that we have to be concerned about.
Thank you.
So we often hear that in popular media that if you don't use it, you lose it. So people who have active lifestyles, who are engaged in more cognitively intensive activities, like for example, I think of Brenda Milner at the Neuro, and they usually preserve their cognition for longer. Is that like a cardiovascular mediated effect, or is that a neuroprotective effect, or what's your take on that?
Well, you have to remember that I am not a doctor, and there are a large number of people in the audience who can answer that question better than me, with much more experience on this. But I will say that you have to also modulate this, because there's a very large number of people who have used their brains very actively all their life who do become seriously demented, Iris Murdoch being perhaps the best known example, Ronald Reagan being another example, and we can go on. So it's certainly not a matter of just doing your crosswords, and it's certainly not a matter of just doing all your exercise regularly, but clearly one of the things that I think is very important is the isolation question. I think older people who become isolated are much more vulnerable because they're not stimulated by anybody enough to use their brains to keep talking, to keep thinking. And I think this is something that we really do need to pay a lot more attention to.
Thank you very much.
Go ahead. Thanks. Thanks very much, Margaret, for, as always, a fabulous talk. Not sure whether to be pleased or not that shifting to Université de Montréal and becoming semi-literate and semi-articulate in both official languages is a good thing or a bad thing. But could you tell us a bit more about the researchers that you've been talking to and also the funding and funding climate around exactly that research on protection? What accounts for these the anomalies and people who display the neuropathology but not the cognitive and other impairment?
I don't think we've got very far with that. And I there are some breakthroughs, obviously, in epigenetics, but I'm not sure that this is necessarily going to answer the neuroprotection question. Mm-hmm. I think the first step that has to be recognized by everybody is that this isn't, as I said, something that just suddenly comes out of the blue, that suddenly at 75 or 80, I won't say granny because that means me, goes demented. It's something that is building up throughout the life cycle. And that's why I gave emphasis to the question of neurotoxins and things like this that affect, even in utero, potential children who, and then again certain kinds of toxic foods and so on all through the life cycle. It is quite clear that people who live in toxic environments are more at risk. But there's a long, long way to go in really doing research into this and refining what neuroprotection means. And I do suspect it's going to be as difficult a problem as is the question of laying out really what we think the Alzheimer's phenomenon is. We're dealing with a very complex process. The brain is the biggest challenge we've ever really had to face, and now we are facing up to it. But it's a big, big task. What we do know is that the environment of various kinds contributes enormously. I didn't have a chance to mention some studies from quite a way back now that I like a lot, which were done with the Yoruba in Africa, and they were then tracked. Some of them migrated and came to America, and the really good epidemiological study that was followed for a good number of years showed low rates of dementia in Africa and increasing rates of dementia among the same genetic group of people in North America. The assumption was that it was due to massive changes of diet and massive changes in lifestyle. And there are several epidemiological studies like this that do show how important the environment is and what impact that can have. But we need more, much more.
I think this needs to be the last question. Thank you.
Okay, I'm glad I got into the line then. I wanted to ask you actually about ethical aspects. You hadn't mentioned that in your lecture, and you said you might in the Q&A. I find that research increasingly is focused on biomarkers and almost as if we're moving towards a memory clinic in the future where people can come in and just get a test and find out if they will develop Alzheimer's even before they have symptoms. I wonder, though, just how ethical this is without
really effective treatments that we can give people. I mean, how useful is it, for example, myself, if I could go right now to a clinic and find out if I'll develop Alzheimer's in 50, 60 years, do I really want to know that information? Do I want that on my conscience? Is it really ethical to put so much emphasis on a test for Alzheimer's before we have effective treatments for Alzheimer's? It's almost like people will come into the clinic, find out a diagnosis, and just leave depressed with little hope for themselves. So I wonder if you could just talk about the ethical aspects. It reminds me a lot of Huntington's disease, to be honest.
I think there are obviously problems involved here. Your point that there is at the moment no medication, no drugs that really make a major difference, means, in fact, in my experience from talking to a very large number of people about this, that they won't go near memory clinics or any other facility where they're likely to be asked to go through cognitive testing. The same with neuroimaging. The assumption on the part of some researchers have been that many people will want to now come and get neuroimaging to see if they have plaques in their brains. I'm sure that's the case in certain parts of the world that I won't mention, where people will rush to get tests. But let's say right here in Canada, perhaps, the majority will not want to rush and do that because they know full well that there is no treatment at the moment. Should effective treatment be developed? And that is still a very difficult challenge because at the moment it looks as though AD is being subdivided into subtypes, probably meaning that there will have to be different medications for those subtypes if and when we get them. But if we get to that stage, then I think it makes a lot of difference for people to go through these kinds of testing. Meantime, the testing that goes on in places like the memory clinics does cause some anxiety for some of the people there because there is no clear answer for a good long time very often. And I'm afraid Dr. Cherko is going to have to allow me to say that sometimes the people actually rement, not very often, I suppose, but they do rement in the clinic, which is good. They probably had some depression or something like that. So it isn't a nice, hard diagnosis, and it is something that has to be validated over a good long time. And some people do resent being because they are essentially a research subject in that sort of situation. Others want to help research and are very willing to go through with it. And by the time they're well into the memory clinic, the people that I've talked to certainly, or their caregivers, it's clear that the majority of those people do need some kind of help. Something very troubling is beginning to happen to them. And it's important to start mobilizing social support and family support. So it does that, if nothing else.
Thank you. On behalf of the Faculty of Medicine, I'd like to thank everyone for coming to tonight's lecture. I guess to inject some levity into the final remarks, the take-home point is to eat chocolate often and soon. And I'd also like to ask you to join me in thanking Dr. Locke for this presentation.